We're doing Parshat Chukat. Our Parsha comes as did the previous one. Our Parsha comes after the transgression of the spies. So our Parsha, Parshat Chukat, is a continuation in a series of events that can be linked to what happened with the spies. So one of the things that happened with the spies is it was decreed the people would die in the desert. And so Parshat Chukat comes to tell us the laws of people's passing, people's defilement, people's purity and impurity. So we'll begin with the basic concept. In Torah we are taught that when a person dies, he is tameh, the body, the corpse, is what we call in halacha, avi avot hatuma, the father of all fathers of defilement. So the deceased human body imparts a defilement that we call tuma. Can it be seen? Well, that's a good question. We assume that tuma cannot be seen. Can it be felt? Well, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if tuma can be felt.
Are there anyone today who can say who can say that they for sure are not impure?
So let's first understand what tuma is, and then we'll see that everyone is tame. There are many different types of tuma. If we were to understand it, I think there are two approaches we can take. There is the real approach, and there is the pleasant approach. I can discuss the pleasant understandings of why the Torah decreed the concept of tumah, but I would much rather, you guys are, Baruch Hashem, on a nice level this class, so I would much rather deal with you on a higher level. On the higher level, I think the approach we're to take is Hashem created realities in this world. And some realities we sense with the naked eye, and some realities the Torah tells us they exist, even though we do not sense it with the naked eye. So the fact that a person doesn't sense certain things does not deny the reality of their existence. In ancient times, people would sense this more. And that's why in ancient times, people would, let's say a woman would have her onset, she was menstruating, so they wouldn't even walk on the earth she stepped on. They sensed the tuma, where we today don't sense it. Most people don't sense tuma and tahara. Tahara is purity, tuma is this form of defilement. Now, the tuma is not as obvious as we might think. So, let's take a few examples. We know that tuma, the concept we will focus on today, is tuma that comes from a body, from a deceased body. But there is also tuma that comes from life. When a person gives birth, when a woman gives birth, so she is tame. So tuma is not only the deceased body. When a woman starts menstruating, she is tame. When a man has a seminal discharge, so he's just perhaps impregnated his wife. So now that's the source of life. Yet the halakha says he is tame, as is his wife. So tuma is a little bit more complex than to just say it's connected to death, even though on some level it probably is always connected to death. Again, we can discuss nicer concepts of how the Torah wanted to ensure that people would not take on the customs of the people of the land, that when a person would die, they would make a carpet of their skin, they would plaster their skin on the wall. They had ways in Egypt of embalming and saving the skin, and people used to have their relatives adorning their homes. And the Torah says, you're not supposed to do that. So the Torah said, if you touch it, if you're in its presence, then you should know you're becoming defiled. But these are nice concepts. The more correct, to my mind, the more correct approach is, first of all, to understand that the Torah revealed to us a reality. It exists in the world. And perhaps we'll visit certain examples of that, but yes.
Was it Yaakov mummified?
And therefore?
But you just said the whole thing about...
I said keeping the body in your home. I didn't say burying a person mummified.
Okay. B, you were talking about... when we were talking that there's Tame, Tahor, and Kadosh. So does Kadosh also impart Kedusha like Tame imparts?
In certain ways. It's a little bit more complex. In certain ways, yes.
And so, you were also saying that Tame... you were giving all these reasons of a tummy of a dead body is because there's no more potential.
Not in this class.
Not in this class. No, before.
Okay, so let's stick to what we're doing right now. I can't be all over the place. We're trying to develop a thought.
Okay.
Let's in Tum'ah, so we have a whole tractate called Seder Taharot. 1/6 of Shas is dedicated to the concept of Tum'ah and Taharah. What are the details that are relevant to us? So let's begin with a classical extreme example. A person dies. Step one, that body is avi avota tumah, is the father of all fathers of tumah. Now, if a human being touches that body, if a human being is in the room with that body, if food or drink are in the room with that body, in the house with that body, under the same canopy with the body, even if they didn't touch it, so then they are all tameh. Everything gets tame. Now, a person, a human being who is in the tent with the body, he becomes an ava tuma. He is the father of tuma. If he is to touch food, that food becomes a rishon le tuma, first level tuma. If that food touches a liquid, the liquid becomes a sheni le tuma, secondary in tuma. Let's take another example. A man was in the tent with a dead body. The dead body again is avi avota tuma. The man who's in the tent is ava tuma. Now he touches a vessel. He touches a spoon, he touches his watch, he touches a pen. Every vessel he touches is tamei, becomes a rishon letumah. If any of those vessels were to touch food or drink, they would make them tamei as well. So when we speak about tumah, we have levels, where the corpse is avi avota tumah. Then we have a level of avatumah. The definition of avatumah, Adam, let me just finish before we take questions. The definition of avatumah is that which has attained the level of tumah, the level of defilement, that it can be mitameh, that it will defile food or even a vessel. It can defile a vessel. So what other examples of avatumah do we have? So if a man has a discharge that is not the regular seminal discharge. There are situations where a person has discharge of some yellowish flow which doesn't even come out when he is hard. And that discharge will cause him to be what's called a zav, a man who has a flow. If a woman has her onset, so she becomes a nida, that's another form of defilement, avatumah. If a woman has a discharge that looks like her menstruation, but it's not at the time when she should menstruate. So that could also make her into a zava, a woman who has a flow. And she's also an avatuma. Now, the zav, if the zav spits, or any of his discharge, his bodily fluids come in contact with other vessels, or they also defile them. So we have a number of things that are avatuma. We said a person who was in a tent with a corpse, or touched a corpse, a person... who has a discharge, zav, or a woman who has her discharge, zava, or a woman who has her onset, or, we'll deal with one final example, and that is, we have 8 shiratzim, creepy crawly creatures, that when they die, these creatures are also, they are also avatuma. So, choled, achbar, tzav, I don't know if choled is... one of those animals that furrow, if cholet is a type of cat or weasel or some kind of animal in that family, I don't know. Achbar is some kind of mouse or rat or something of that nature. Tzav is some kind of turtle. Yeah, Chomet, Tinshamet, we have other names, which I'm not exactly sure what any of them are, but if you want, some of the Chumashim upstairs have pictures. I recommend you guys familiarize yourself with Rav Arya Kaplan's The Living Torah, and he also brings pictures there of what these might be. So we, in the days of the temple, people knew what they were. Today, our assumption is that we've all come into contact with a pen or a watch, or a fork or a spoon, and so we're tameh. So you'll ask me, why is a pen or a watch tameh? Because we said that a metal object that comes into the same tent as a corpse becomes defiled. Now it becomes as defiled as the corpse, meaning a human being who's in the tent with the corpse, he becomes an avatuma, and anyone he comes in contact with, anything he comes in contact with, is going to be only a rishon, only first. But the Torah tells us in our parasha that the sword that kills a person, the sword becomes as defiled as the dead body. And Chazal taught us that it wasn't only the sword, but any metal object that comes not only in contact, but into the same tent as the corpse, gets the level of the corpse. So that means that all around us we have objects that are avi avota tumah. Who paid attention the last time they went to a funeral, what pen they were wearing, what watch they were wearing? Okay, so we come in contact with metal objects. Even if you don't come in contact with corpses, you come in contact with metal objects that were in the same tent as a corpse. So that's why our assumption is that no one on the planet is pure. Everyone's defiled. How do you get out of that? How do you become pure? So on a lower level of tumah, on a lower level of defilement, the Torah says it's enough to go to mikvah. Almost always when you go to mikveh, you have to wait for nightfall. Sometimes the Torah says you have to go to mikveh and also bring a sacrifice. A woman who gives birth must bring a sacrifice. A person who's a zava, a woman that had her flow at the not natural time, will also have to bring a sacrifice. You have a mitzora, we didn't discuss that yet, that a person that has that white blemish that makes him so defiled that even if you're under the same tent as him, you can become defiled. So he also has to bring a sacrifice, a korban, when he becomes pure. So there are scenarios where it's not enough to go to mikveh. Sometimes there's a whole procession, like a man who has tzaras has to do his whole procession to become pure. But then you have the highest form of defilement. A person who came in contact with a corpse. So now you want to become pure. We all want to go up to the temple to bring a sacrifice. We all want to go and eat holy foods. This year is the first year of the Shemitah cycle. So if you're going to pick grapes, you're going to take off Truma, Maaser Rishon, and then you'll take off Maaser Shemini, the second tithe. The second tithe has to be eaten in purity in Jerusalem. Can we be pure and go up to Jerusalem and eat our Maaser Shemini, our second tithe? All our fruits, right? This year is the first year of the Shemitah cycle. All our fruits must be taken. You have to take off a second tithe, which you yourself eat up in Jerusalem. Well, you have to be pure when you eat it. So every Jew has an interest in being pure. For many reasons, not only for the temple, even for other mitzvot we do at home. But it's hard. How do you stay on top of things? So if it's a part of life, so when a woman would have her onset, she would have separate utensils she would eat. Now remember, it's only the corpse, it's only the body of a dead person that makes the whole tent defiled, everything in the tent. Every other tumah doesn't do that other than tzarat. By tzarat, you have a stone from the house that has the white blemish. There we say that anything that comes under the same canopy is tameh. A person who has tzarat, a person that has this white blemish that's called tzarat, that defilement, he can make anyone that's under the same canopy as him tameh. But generally, our assumption is every other tum'ah, every other form of defilement, doesn't affect anyone else that's under the same tent. You have to come in contact with the person. So generally, when a woman would have her onset, even today, when a woman has her onset, so her husband doesn't touch her. I mean, the couple stay separate till she goes to mikveh, till she goes and immerses herself in the mikveh waters. But in ancient times, they were careful that she would have her separate set of dishes that she would use. And I assume that the kids ate from the same dishes as her, because she was feeding the kids. I mean, you're not home all day to feed the kids. So it could be the way it worked was the other way, that he would have a separate set of dishes if he could stay pure. You know, the whole house ran with one thing, and when she'd go to mikveh, she'd take with her the dishes she used. They would dunk the dishes with her. Everything would become pure with her. It was a whole procession. Okay, but remember, in ancient times, they didn't have forks. made life easier. I mean, they had a total of 8 dishes, the whole house. I'm saying, how many dishes did they have? Everything was handmade. It wasn't such a big deal. Their house was less than the size of this room. An average house was tiny. I mean, they didn't have big houses in general. I mean, the kings had castles like the homes we live in, but the average person had a tiny house. So they didn't have that many vessels. So when they went to mikveh, everyone went to mikveh. The wife went, the kids went, everyone went together. It was a family event, right? Today, we don't have that. So today, when a woman has her onset, no one knows. We don't talk about it. When a woman goes to mikveh, no one knows. We don't talk about it. It's not considered modest to talk about it because it's not relevant to anyone. In the days of the temple, the whole family, everyone knew who was pure and who wasn't. I mean, the family lived differently. Now, when it comes to the defilement, the tum'ah, of a dead body, so the Torah in our parsha tells us, how do you get out of it? How do you become pure? And that is the procession of the red heifer, which we will discuss in a moment. Yes, Adam?
So, what makes a vessel a vessel?
A metal vessel, the second it was refined. A wooden vessel, if it was refined and it has airspace. In other words, it has to have what's called in halacha a toch. It has to have some kind of crevice. If you have a flat wooden vessel, that's not called a vessel, a flat board. It has to have a lip. It has to have an inside. And an earthenware vessel also. It has to be finished off as a vessel. We have a concept called gmar melacha. Did you finish it off? So in ancient times, they had a tool called a goad. A goad was a stick that had a little nail coming out of it. And when the animal wanted to go off the path as it was plowing, it would bump into the nail and go back on the path. Ouch. So that's called a goad. So that little nail was a tool. You put it by the plow. Once you finished making it, that's a tool. That's a vessel. Today our vessels are more sophisticated. But once you finished making a vessel, so then it's defined as a vessel. Again, in order for it to be a wooden vessel, it has to have an inside. In order for it to be a cloth vessel, it has to have a minimum size of 3 fingers by 3 fingers. Gimel etzbos by gimel etzbos. That's in a nutshell. Obviously, there's a whole tractate called Kalim with 30 chapters defining vessels. But in a nutshell, that's an overview of vessels.
Plastic's not in
Thursday night. We can discuss plastic and halacha. It's a good question. You know, plastic, polyester. If you have a polyester shirt, does it need tzitzis? Can you make polyester tzitzis? It's a good question. Thursday night. If you have a plastic vessel, can you kasher it? Do you have to immerse it in a mikveh? How does plastic fall into halacha? Oh, that's a good question for a Thursday night. Yes, only because I want to give you a broad answer. Meaning I could give you an inconclusive. Let's try to cover it in depth. But write it down, guys. How are you going to remember it till Thursday night? Who's going to remember plastic till Thursday night? Write it somewhere on Thursday night. We'll deal. We'll try. Bezrat Hashem. We'll try to deal. Yes. Oh, good. So we continue. So how do we get pure? How do we get out of this situation of defilement? So the Torah tells us something which we call a chok. It is, in certain respects, considered the most complex mitzvah in the Torah. That King Solomon says about this mitzvah, Amarti ech kama, I thought I'd get so smart, but it's still beyond me. Chazal said he was talking about this mitzvah, that there are aspects of the mitzvah of Parah Aduma, the red cow, that King Solomon said, I still don't understand why it should be so. What's the idea? The Torah says you take a red cow. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, what is red? Simple question, what's red? Yeah, so all of us went to kindergarten, and we know what red is, right? We all took our test in colors. But it's not so simple in halacha.
Crimson red, firework red.
What were you going to say, Lawrence?
That it's defined as not having more than, that having a maximum of 2 hairs of black color.
Right? Oh, okay, wait, that's that it should be completely red. I'm asking colors.
Is it green?
So red is not green, but green is not green. Okay? Green, I'll explain. Green, in Torah terminology, yarok, means devoid of red. green, by definition, in our sages' terminology, yarok, green, is not only green. Yarok includes gold, includes green, includes yellow. How are all these colors? And white, whitish, grayish. How? And blue. How does it include all those colors? Because yarok is not what we in modern Hebrew call yarok green. Yarok means devoid of red. So in different contexts, different colors are called yarok. But that's not our topic tonight. We're not talking about green. We're talking about red. Okay, so what is red? So let's analyze this for a minute. We know blood is red, okay? So when we look at this book, that's red. So my red cow has to be that red. What else is red?
Blood is red, but
there's
oxygen.
Ah, so wait. But what other red do we have? Where else do we have red? Al tere yain ki git adam ki ten bakoseino. Wine is called red. We would call wine purple, right? But that's called red, right? Al tere yain ki git adam. I know they call it red wine, but I've never seen wine that looked like blood.
Brown?
Oh, so then we go over to brown. It's brown red. Because if you leave blood to sit a little bit, it turns brown.
Or black,
right? So we have many, many, many terms of definition in colors. Colors happens to be a very developed science in Chazal. Just for the word white, we have 8 to 12 types of white. We have white as snow. We have white as an egg. We have white as milk. We have white as wool. Chazal broke down colors into two types of definitions. There's the dilution of the color, meaning if I take a color and I add water to it, that's the dilution of the color. So let's say if I take a dark coffee and I keep adding water to it, so that black will turn into brown until it'll turn into clear. That's one type of, one aspect of colors. And there's another aspect, which is when I add white to the color. So if I take a dark coffee and I add a drop of milk and another drop of milk and another drop of milk, I'm headed in a different direction. So those are two aspects of colors that Chazal discussed. When we talk about what I'm telling you now is Mishnayos and Talmud. The Talmud discusses the depth of color. The Talmud has different terms for how we analyze color. But the Talmud discusses different types of dilution, adding water or adding milk, adding clear, meaning making the color more diluted, or adding white to the color, making the color less powerful. So those are two elements that we discuss in colors. But when we read, you need a red cow, so let's not be deceived. The word cow we might understand, but the word red, that deserves a lot of insight. What is red? What is defined as red in halacha? So we need the cow to be completely red. My impression from you guys is that you want to understand the breadth and depth. I've never discussed these subjects before, but you guys are giving me the impression that you want this much depth. Am I wrong? You could say yes. I'm wrong. Okay. So we want a cow that's whole in its redness. And the cow must be that it has no blemish. And the cow must be a cow that never carried a yoke. So the Talmud tells us a great story. There was once a man who wanted to deceive the sages. He had a red cow born in his flock. He called in the sages. And the sages came and looked over the cow. They saw it had no blemish. They saw all its hairs were red. Perfect. They settled on a price. And they said, okay, we'll come back to close the deal tomorrow. He called over all his buddies and he said, I'm going to trick the rabbis. I'm going to do them in. So he told his buddies, you see, the rabbis know, it says in the Torah, you're not supposed to use a red cow that carried a yoke on it. And the rabbis checked my cow and they said, my cow's perfect. And they're going to pay me millions for this cow. And now I'm going to win them twice. I'm going to get the money and trick him and make the cow disqualified. And he took a yoke and he put it on the cow and then he walked the cow a little bit and the cow carried the yoke and then he took off the yoke, put the cow back in its barn, and He waited to the next morning, rubbing his hands. He's going to make millions off the rabbis and trick them too. So the rabbis show up the next morning. They bring in bags of money. And they say, wait, we got to look over the cow before we take the money. Got to make sure nothing changed. They look over the cow and they come back and they say, we're very, very sorry. We really thought we were going to buy your cow, but we're not going to buy your cow. So the guy says, why? And they said, because when we were here yesterday, that cow never carried a yoke. And when we came today, the cow did carry a yoke. So now it's disqualified from being our red heifer. So he said, no, I promise, it never carried a yoke. What are you talking about? Just like yesterday, that's what it is today. And the rabbis say, no, maybe someone did it behind your back. We don't know. Bottom line, that cow carried a yoke. We can't take the cow. So he started arguing and fighting, and he was very upset. How did they know? The rabbis had a tradition that there are two hairs by the cow's neck that remain erect. And when the yoke goes on them, bends them down, and then you can't stand them up again. So when they would check a red heifer, they wouldn't tell the seller, but they would also check those hairs. So they came the day before, the hairs were standing. They knew the cow had never carried a yoke. They came the next day, the hairs were bent. But this is a tradition they didn't reveal to anyone, meaning this was a way of checking that the guy wasn't trying to trick them. So we have to ensure that the cow did not carry a yoke. There's a discussion in Talmud, what happens if the cow mated? If a male cow climbed on top of the female cow and they mated, is that considered that it carried a yoke? So what do we do with the red heifer? The Kohen Gadol does not do the red heifer. We have his assistant do the red cow. And we have two things that are unique in the Torah. We have two sacrifices where we do the sacrifice outside the temple. One is the red heifer, and the other is on Yom Kippur, the Seir Lazazel. And so these are two areas where Chazal say there's deep Kabbalistic insights, and Chazal tell us that the nations would always argue with us, you see, you're just like us, you don't just worship God in the temple, you do things outside the temple too, just like us, where we do all kinds of paganistic rituals. But Chazal say that's not true. I mean, the Torah tells us the way to do the red heifer. Where would they take the red heifer? So they would take it on top of a mountain, just opposite the temple. And they would open all the gates to the temple, and the man standing on the mountain would look in, and he would be able to see into the Holy of Holies. And when you calculate, when you learn Masechet Midot, the calculation of all the steps leading up in the temple, because you know the temple was built in an ascending order. You entered the temple, you had a courtyard, you had to climb a few steps to the next level. Then every time it got holier, you had to climb a few steps. All the steps total, between all the steps, the bottom step, upper step, and the doorpost, meaning if you were standing on bottom and you looked up, and you looked up through all of them, so what you could see was like this much width between where you stood and the upper doorpost, because your doorpost and the ground kept going up as you went up the temple. And this was to facilitate the Kohen who stood outside, who stood on the mountain opposite the temple, he would look across and look and see the Holy of Holies. He'd look straight across the temple. So the Kohen takes the animal outside, and he's going to slaughter it. And when he slaughters it, they're going to burn it. They're going to take some of the blood, sprinkle it in the direction of the temple, and then they burn it with everything. Its skin, everything gets burnt. They would add as many logs as possible to the burning, because the ashes of the red cow would be used in the future. Anytime you had people who got defiled, they would take water drawn from a stream, sprinkle a drop of ash on those waters, and then that whole bucket could be used to sprinkle on people and purify them from defilement. That's, in a nutshell, the laws of the red heifer. Now, you understand that a drop of ash on a big bucket of water, so you can help, you can service, let's say, 1,000 people with each bucket. Because every person has to be touched just by one drop of water. You don't need more than that. But eventually you finish the red heifer. How many red heifers were there in history? Nine. The Mishnah says there were nine. The tenth will be done by Mashiach. The first one of Moshe Rabbeinu lasted the whole period of the first temple. The second temple had another eight. And then after that, now, till when did the red heifer last? Till about 150 years after the destruction of the temple. In the days of the end of the Mishnah, they still had ashes from the red heifer, and they still had pious people who would use the ashes of the red heifer. In the days of Rebbe, the Talmud tells us they still had ashes from the red heifer and people who could live that way. You couldn't do another red heifer till you had a temple. So the red heifer lasted about 2.5 centuries after the destruction of the temple. Maybe 2 centuries, lasted approximately that long after the destruction of the temple. Now, we had an ongoing battle. Our battle began with Korach, and every generation had, not every, but many generations had their Korach. Meaning, throughout our history, there were people who said, I don't buy into this tradition thing. I interpret the Torah the way I think. And in one period of Jewish history, namely the period of the Second Temple, so you had groups like this. You had the Karaites, Karaim, which were actually an offshoot, because initially you had the Sadducees and the Baitusees, which were actually an offshoot, because originally you had the Samaritans, the Shomronim, which were actually an offshoot, because initially you had the Kutim. So we have about 5 terms that we use them interchangeably, but really, when the first temple was destroyed, so the northern 10 tribes were exiled, I'm sorry, about a number of years before the destruction of the first temple, when Sanherib came and exiled the northern 10 tribes, as we discussed Thursday night, so he brought in many people to inhabit that territory. Those people were brought primarily from an island called Kavta, and so they were called Kutim, the people of Kavta. And when they came in, they did not really adopt the Torah the way we keep Torah. They weren't interested in keeping Torah altogether. But they were attacked by lions, which was unnatural in Israel. So they asked the king, send us someone to teach us how to worship the God of this land. So they brought back a Kohen, who had hoped that if he educates them a little bit, they'll say, we can't do this, bring back the Jews. So he educated them a little bit, and they did do it. The little bit he taught them. They continued being pagans, and they kept the Torah to some degree. And they felt that the lions stopped attacking them, and they remained in Israel. They evolved into what we call the Samaritans, because they said their capital is Shomron. That's Shomron, Samaria. Yeah. So they evolved from being the Kutim to the Samaritans, the Shomronim. So their capital was Samaria, and we sometimes call them Kutim and sometimes Shomronim. When we came back, let's finish the thought, when we came back to the land of Israel, so they challenged us and they fought us and they said, we're the Jews, what are you guys doing here? And we want to build the temple. And they tried to kill Ezra and they tried to kill Nehemiah and they tried to sabotage the rebuilding of the Second Temple and they made us a lot of problems. And for the whole period of the Second Temple, they were challenging us. So we have the Kutim, otherwise known as the Shomronim, the Samaritans. Ezra convenes a special court, 300 men, 300 shofros, and they make a ban that the Kutim shouldn't be allowed to marry into Israel, and their meat should be considered pig's meat, and their bread should be considered also pig's meat, not kosher. No one should have anything to do with them. A little bit later in Jewish history, they make peace with us, they convert, they do gir, and for the next 3 centuries, there's a question, till past the destruction of the Second Temple, what are they? Are they real Jews or not? Until after the Second Temple is destroyed in the period of Rabbi Meir, they verify and they discover that on the top of Mount Gerizim they have figurines of doves and they worship them, and the rabbis decide they're all not Jewish and they banish them and they're out of the Jewish people. They're not Jewish. Okay, but throughout the period of the Second Temple there was a question what they were up to. That's one group. Let's just finish. We move forward to the next group. About 100 years into the Second Temple period, you have a giant named Antigonus Ish Soho. Antigone, the leader of the area of Soho. Antigone teaches his students, don't worship God for the sake of reward. He has 2 top students named Tzadok and Baitus. Tzadok and Baitus both decide, what is he talking about? Must be there is no world to come. Why is he telling us not to do it for the world to come? No. So they develop the Essene philosophy, which says, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die. Let's enjoy life now. And so they decide that...
The Essene?
Epicureanism. Let's enjoy life now. Sadducim, Baitusim.
I saw the Essenes were some ascetics living in this.
Epicurus is Epicurean.
Accordion.
Let's wait. We'll get there.
Okay.
Wait. So... Tzadok and Baitus both decide that they don't believe the oral tradition. And they develop a following which archaeologists say today were strongest in among the priests, the Kohanim. And Tzadok and Baitus develop movements that have the backing of some of the kings of the Second Temple. because some of the Hasmonean kings find it very comfortable to adopt a way of life that disregards the rabbis. And then they proceed to not only join the Sadducee movement, but to kill any of the rabbis from the Prushim, or I think they're called in English Pharisees, the rabbis who went with tradition. And what ends up happening is, with the support of the king, they end up taking control of the courts. And one of the days that were celebrated in the period of the Second Temple was when we regained the court into our hands. So they would sometimes control the temple and the court. So the rabbis had a challenge, because the Sadducees were Jews, the Sadducees and Bictuses, they were Jews, who deep down inside knew they were wrong, but on the outside they would fight us, and they would say, we're doing our way, we're okay. So what did the rabbis do? The rabbis would repeatedly try to do things that would corner the Sadducees, so that the Sadducees would have to admit, we believe your way. So let's take an example. On Yom Kippur, when they would bring the sacrifice of Yom Kippur, they never knew if the high priest was deep down inside a Sadducee. So our tradition is that you could put the ktores, the incense, on the coals outside, or you could put it inside. But we promoted the opinion that you must put it inside, even though technically we didn't say that it was disqualified if you put it outside. But we preferred, because our tradition said that it was kosher to put the coals down in the Holy of Holies and then put the ktores on the coals. The Sadducees said that you may not put the ktores on the coals inside. You have to put the incense on the coals outside and then walk in with everything smoking. So what did the rabbis do? Just before Yom Kippur, they would take the Kohen Gadol aside and say, we want you to swear by God's name that you are going to do it the way we taught you and put the incense on the ktores inside the Holy of Holies. And then they'd burst out crying. They'd say, we're sorry, we have to suspect you. It's not nice. And he'd burst out crying. What are you suspecting me, that I won't go by tradition? But they had good reason to suspect them. Now, technically you'd say, why shouldn't we be pluralistic? Live and let live. If we agree that technically you could put the incense outside and then bring it in, let's do it in a way that everyone agrees is fine. And the answer is that when you contend with a lie, you don't compromise with a lie. The rabbi said, on the contrary, let's corner them and force them to admit and go with our tradition. So the rabbi said, you have to promise you're only going to do it that way. Otherwise, we're not going to let you do the service. And the Kohen Gadol would promise by God's name. When it came to the red heifer, so all of a person's purity was dependent on the red heifer, because everyone becomes tamei sometimes. So what the rabbis did was they said, Sadducees, you believe that the only way you could make the red heifer is if everyone involved is completely, completely pure. We, based on our tradition, the Sadducees invented their understanding. They didn't have a tradition. They said, we'll do it the way we see fit. Our tradition, says the rabbis, is that a person can touch one of those eight vermin. You remember we said there are eight vermin that make you defile, shmona shratzim. He can touch them. Go to mikvah before nightfall. You remember we said you need nightfall until you become completely pure. But once he's gone to mikvah, even before nightfall, he is still kosher to do the process of the red heifers. So what did the rabbis do? Anyone who came to deal with the red heifer would first have to touch one of these dead creatures, go to mikvah, and then start the procession. And this was a way of saying to the Sadducees, if you accept our tradition, you have a red heifer. If you don't accept our tradition, you don't have a red heifer. So what are you going to do? You can't purify yourself. And again, what was the logic behind this? The Talmud tells us the following story. One Kohen Gadol came to his father and said, you guys are big talkers, he said to his father. You guys always say we should do things our way, but you never do it. You're only talking. You're all talk. I was Kohen Gadol, and I went into the Holy of Holies this year, and I did it the way we always said you should do it. I put the incense on the coals outside, and then I brought it inside, and I tricked all the rabbis, and I did it the way we always said. So his father looked at him and said, I wonder if you'll live out your year. And it says his son did not live out his year. He died that year. So when I read that, I said, wow, you see, even the father who taught him to be a Sadducee deep down inside, he knew it wasn't right. And so Rambam writes If you're not going to go with tradition, one of your challenges in life is that you could never be happy. Because if you're always trying to figure out, what do I think the Torah is saying? So today you think this, tomorrow you'll figure out a different interpretation. There's never an end. It's all up to what I think. If I'm working based on tradition, I'm saying, this is the tradition from Moshe, from Sinai. I'm doing what I have to do. I could be happy. I could sleep well at night. So the Sadducees kept arguing with us, but they didn't really believe their argument. And what the rabbis did with the red heifer was they tried to corner the Sadducees to admit that in truth we agree with your tradition. And that's why everything that was done with the red heifer was done firstly by people who were defiled and went to mikvah. And then the rabbi said, we have a problem. People won't take the red heifer seriously because they'll say everyone that's dealing with it is a little tameh. So the rabbis went to the opposite extreme and made stringencies like they didn't make in any other place in Torah with regards to the red heifer, and we'll see a few of them in a minute. Just 1 second. I know before I asked you if we should have the windows open or the air conditioning on, but as I see drooping heads, I can either say it's because of me or because the air conditioning's off. So I'd much rather say it's because the air conditioning's off. So maybe we should turn on the air conditioning and close the windows, because I think the heat is affecting people. I think. Yes?
It seems like in the Mishnah that it was more obvious that the Kohen Gadol was a Sadducee, being that it says if he couldn't read, they would read the laws to him.
Okay. Look at Rabbeinu Avadia and Bartimu. He says not that they were Sadducees, but rather that they weren't learned, that they were appointed by the king, not based upon their merits.
And if the Sadducees didn't actually believe in what they were doing, they would be breaking more laws than just the red heifer and the Ketoret.
Right. That's true.
So did they do those? Did they walk the walk like they would?
I don't know. Seems that way, but I don't know.
I know it doesn't really take into what you're talking about, but these were not Kohanim.
Who were not Kohanim?
The second temple.
What do you mean?
These were people who bought the honor to be Kohen Gadol. They were not Kohanim.
I'm unaware of it saying that they were not Kohanim, but rather they were Kohanim who were not fit to be Kohanim Gadolim. Okay, so let's discuss some of the stringencies. You guys fasten your seatbelts? You ready? Okay, so stringency number one. The person who would draw the water for sprinkling the red heifer had to be a child that was never defiled in their whole life. So they would take this mountaintop on top of, and they'd create this little village where no, you couldn't die there. That was the rule. Okay, I'm joking. You couldn't die there, but no one could really access those kids. They'd be born on the mountaintop. They'd be there with their mother. They'd have a few kids. They'd have a little community there. And these kids would be brought up on that mountaintop, where they knew that on that mountaintop there was no defilement. They would dig all the way till they hit the rock, which they knew had been there from creation. And on that mountaintop, they'd bring up these kids. When they brought the kids to draw the water, they would have cows. And on the cows, they would put a door, like a big plank, so that in case they passed over a grave, the tum'ah would not hit the kids. It gets stopped by a roof, so they would have a roof. Oh, so tum'ah, one of the concepts of tum'ah is that when you have a body or you have a limb, you know, if someone has an arm amputated, so the tum'ah, anything that overhangs, anything that overshadows it, that's on top of it, gets tameh. Tum'ah shoots up until it hits a ceiling. So so if you had a door, they were riding on a door, so in case they passed over a grave, the tum'ah would hit the door, but it wouldn't go beyond that, so the kids wouldn't become tameh. So you'll ask me, how do we walk the streets? And the answer is, this is an extraordinary stringency. We're not worried there's a grave right there. We're not worried everywhere we walk there's a grave. This was an extraordinary stringency. Our sages said, if we're doing these leniencies to fight the Sadducees, we have to counterbalance that with extraordinary stringencies. For example, when they draw the water had to be held in front. If you put the water over your shoulder, if there was a minute you didn't see the water, we say, maybe a dead worm fell in and fell out, or it's no longer qualified for being used for the red heifer. You really think something happened to the water when you weren't looking? Doesn't matter. Extra stringency to counterbalance our leniencies. And the final stringency we'll discuss today is that they had a special bridge that led to the mountaintop where they would do the red heifer procession. And this bridge was made what's called in halacha kifin al gabei kifin, which is another way of saying an arch on top of an arch. And I'll draw it on the board. I'll understand it.
Is there no looks on that poster?
Could be. What poster?
It's a bridge with a lot of arches.
Yeah, very good. That's what's on the poster. Very good. So we'll explain that right now. You can see it on the poster. The idea is as follows. If we have Mr. Corpse over here, and we have a bridge that goes over it, okay? So our bridge. So then the corpse, the defilement, the tumah shoots up, and anyone that walks over here is tummy. So what do? We do a bridge that's built like this. And so now, if I have a corpse over here, the tumah ends at this ceiling. If I have a corpse over here, under this post, so tumah shoots up, it ends up over here. Right? So on top of these double arches, I've ensured that if there's ever a body anywhere, it was stopped. It was stopped either by this arch or by this arch. And then my bridge runs up here, above both arches. And that's what you see over there in the picture, the double arch bridge. Again, is this necessary biblically? No. It was a rabbinic stringency to counterbalance the rabbinic leniencies that were in place with the red heifer. Okay, so with that, we've basically gone over what we're going to study today about the red heifer. Let's move forward. A person touches a dead body. How do they become pure? They come to the Kohen 3 days after they were defiled, and then 7 days they get sprinkled on the third and the seventh day, and then that night they go to mikveh, and that night they are tahor. What happens? You don't know when you became defiled, so three means a minimum of three. Meaning if you were defiled a week ago or a year ago, you could go today because 3 days has passed. And then you count another 4 days till day number seven from today or whatever that span, that time period, right? And then you get sprinkled on and you go to mikvah. Yes?
Do I have to go to the Kohen next to my village or do I have to go to the Kohen?
You have to go to the Kohen by the temple. It was done there, wasn't it?
Somebody who got defiled in the Golan is to go to Yerushalayim for that.
Yeah. Even though there is a medrash that says they gave each tribe from the ash of the red heifer. There is such a medrash. Yes.
Did they do that on Shabbat too?
Generally not. The Gemara in Yuma brings a machloket whether you could do it on Shabbat or not. Generally not.
So would you just do it on the 8th day? 6th day?
Or you would calculate it to get it around that. Okay. We move forward. The people come to the desert of Tzin. And Rashi brings a medrash here that this pasuk, in the beginning of what they call the 20th chapter, tells you skip 38 years, you're at the 40th year. Meaning the Torah doesn't tell us exactly when the 38 years passed. And the Torah now says Miriam is going to pass away. So Rashi learns, Rashi's quoting a medrash, that when the Torah says the whole congregation came to the desert of Tzin and Miriam passed away, the idea of the whole congregation came to the desert of Tzin is there to tell you that that's it. Everyone who had to die had died. And you've passed the 40 years. So this is where the 40 years pass. In Parshat Chukat. Yes?
Is that Har Sinai?
Is Midbar Tzin Har Sinai.
There's a Nachal Tzin here in Israel that's not far from Eilat. I mean, it says in the Gemara that it's that the Midbar Tzin is Har Sinai.
Yeah, remind me where.
Here.
Yeah.
The bottom of the page.
There are different names like Chore.
I learned it last week.
But. Okay. Tzin. Why don't you look at Tosos? Just look. We'll continue. So they've come to Midbar Tzin, wherever that is. And they're settled in a place called Kadesh, and Miriam passes away. How old was Miriam when she passed away?
126.
Well, if it's the end of the 40 years, then I guess if Moshe is 120 and Aaron is 123, and Miriam, it seems, was their bigger sister, so she was 124 or somewhere in that range. Why does Miriam die? The answer is we don't know. Doesn't say. That's one good answer. That's one good answer, that I guess her time was up. The difficulty with that answer is the Medrash we mentioned 2 weeks ago, that all the other women did not die in the 40 years and they made it alive into Israel. So that would certainly raise a question as to why Miriam would die. But that's, we'll leave that hanging. Miriam has led a very fruitful life. Miriam was pious from the time she was a child. She had prophecy. In a minute, Miriam began her life being ill. No one wanted to marry her until she was a pretty old lady. And then Kalev, who was 40 years younger than her, marries her. And she shares Kalev with Batya, the daughter of Pharaoh. They're both married to Kalev. Initially, Miriam can't have kids until the story when she speaks about Moshe and she gets tzaras. And then when she gets cured from her tzaras, so she gets cured from her bad looks and she gets cured from all her medical illnesses as well. And so when she comes back to the camp, people go wild. Anyone that looks at her would run home to his wife and say, I want to buy you a gift. Let's build our relationship. And she'd say, what happened? And he says, well, I saw a lady that was very, very attractive. And I don't want to think about her. I want to think about you. So let's work on our relationship. That's what the Gemara says. So it says, so Miriam, when she was cured from her leprosy, became extraordinarily attractive. Now, Kalev married her. I'll get to you in a second, Leo. Kalev married her for the sake of heaven. He said, if her brothers are so pious, then only good things can come of this. And so he took care of her. Think about it. He married an old lady who had medical problems, and he spent his first years of marriage taking good care of her, dealing with all her medical treatments. And then later on, she got cured, and he had the dynasty which ultimately led to King David, David HaMelech. But Miriam, in spite of her piety, where as a youngster she risked her lives, working side by side with her mother as a midwife, giving birth to the children, risking her life. When Pharaoh had asked her to be intimate with him, she had refused, risked her life for her purity, and led a very, very pure life. But she had the difficulty of not getting married until a very, very late age. And then, miraculously, when she was cured, after speaking about Moshe, she could have children, and then she had a bunch of children and the whole dynasty that came from Kalev. As I mentioned earlier, Batya also married Kalev, the daughter of Pharaoh who took Moshe in, so she was even older than Miriam. Right? So Kalev had two old wives. I'm saying he had Miriam and Batya, two very pious women, right? As has been the custom by many Gerim, that they take on names that refer to God. That's why the daughter of Pharaoh took on the name Batya, and the convert who Hillel spoke to took on the name Gamliel. I also have a God now, right? Gamliel. And we find throughout Tanakh, that throughout Tanakh and Shas, the people who converted took on names that reference the idea that I now have God as my God is my God. Ovadia, right? So that's another convert we find in Tanakh. Ovadia, I will serve Hashem, yeah. There are more examples to that. Tosfos says there was one person whose name was Avshalom, who was a convert. So Tosfos says, no convert would call himself Avshalom. Avshalom was a wicked person. He named himself Avi Shalom. My father is Hashem, whose name is peace. Avi Shalom is the way of converts to take on a name. But a convert could take any name he wants. I'm saying, you know, Unculus took on a name. I don't know what Unculus means. There are quite a few names by pious people. I mean, Unculus was a giant. Unculus was a ger, and also Achilas was a ger. I don't know what the word Achilas means. Maybe that means in Greek, I have a god. Maybe. I don't know. I'm just saying that's so that's a quick summary of Miriam. There's more to discuss, but we have people who have questions. So yes.
Was Miriam a Shifra then?
I thought she was Pua.
She was Pua.
Thought so, yeah.
Well,
you're saying.
Just a second, Leo's son? First. Yeah, huh?
Wasn't Hur her son?
That's a great question. So according to the Medrash, that Hur was her son, then she was able to have a child before the story of Moshe. That is correct. You are right. The two Medrashim have to be in conflict. Right. I think they're in conflict. I don't have another answer. Right? Unless the Medrash means that other than Hur, she couldn't have kids. That she had one and couldn't have more. I don't know. If you want to look it up, it's a Gemara in two places. It's in Sota and in Megillah. It's in two places, the Gemara. Which daf? Oh. Well, when you bring me a Gemara, I'll look. Yeah. Let's not do it on class time. Remind me. Email me. I'll send you the exact location. No. No, because the second year in the desert, she already has a 12-year-old boy named Hur. If Hur is Miriam's son, so when did the story of talking bad about Moshe happen? The second year in the desert, she already has a son who's 12 years old named Hur. I'm sorry, a grandson. A great-grandson. I'm sorry. Because she has Bezalel, who is the son of Uri, who is the son of Hur, and Bezalel is already 12. So if she has a great-grandson, Bezalel, who is the son of Uri, the son of Hur, the son of Miriam, then going with that medrash, that Hur was Miriam's son, so then that medrash either says she was able to have one child and then no more, or that medrash is disagreeing with the medrash that says that.
But if she already had a great-grandson, who cares if she was able to have one son?
They want to marry her.
What?
Normally, you want to have a child with the woman you married. Wouldn't you care?
No, she got a shot after the
event.
I'm bringing an example. It's like winning a championship in sports. After you win one, you want to win more. When you have one, you want to have more.
No, but you can't compare a woman with a bad Estera with a woman that has great.
Agreed. Agreed.
There was that one story.
Agreed. No, it's a very good point. Thank you, Leah. Very good. Yeah, it's a very good point. Yes.
You mentioned that there was a question why she had to die compared to all other women.
Correct.
Not comparing it to other women, the brothers also died.
Who?
The brothers also died.
Right, but they were told why. By Miriam, we're not told why.
Well, maybe that's still a connection.
We'd have to prove it. So Chazal tell us why is Miriam's death adjacent to the red heifer? So there's a recurring theme with the red heifer, that the red heifer is called in the Torah Chatat. And Chazal refer to the red heifer as though it were a sacrifice. So there's an element in the red heifer that it's like a sacrifice. And Chazal say that Miriam's passing is mentioned next to the red heifer to tell us that the passing of tzaddikim is also an atonement for the people, just like a chatas sacrifice. So the Torah Tmima explains that to mean that when a tzaddik dies, you ask yourself, what did he do? Why did he have to die? And the biggest question was on Miriam. Because if all the women are living to the age of 150 and 60 and 170 until they come into the land, so Miriam, who led the women, why did she have to die? She didn't hit the rock. What did she do wrong? And the Torah doesn't tell us why she had to die. So the idea that we have to contend with a tzaddik dying, we look at him and we say, why did he have to die? Why? I can understand other people dying, but why the tzaddik? You don't understand. You deal with it, you accept it, just like the red heifer. You don't understand. You don't understand why the red heifer should work. Why should this little amount of ash affect the water, which affects the person, and the one who sprinkles it, he becomes tameh, but the one who gets sprinkled on, he becomes tahor, which isn't exactly true, but we'll make believe it is. So that says, the Torah Tmima, that's the idea. They don't have an answer. And when you accept it, and you get aroused by it, that if even the tzaddik dies, then I better become a better person, because that means I'm also going to die one day. So that's part of the atonement of a tzaddik's passing. Okay, let's move forward. Miriam passes away and there's no water. So suddenly we realize all the 40 years we had water was because of Miriam. And that's a rule in life. We never appreciate the blessings we have. The people had Miriam, they never realized that it was in Miriam's merit that they had water all these years. When Miriam dies and suddenly there's no water, then they appreciate it. So this is an important concept, which is a double-edged sword. Whenever people consider switching jobs, leaving yeshivas, switching to another yeshiva, I always say there are two points to consider, two sides of a coin. Point number one is, very often people remain stagnant. They don't grow because they don't have the courage to make a move. Sometimes people have to make the move in order to grow. You have to let go. You can't jump off the diving board without letting go. And you're never going to swim if you don't jump off the diving board. So in order to move forward, you have to be willing to take the risks of change. That's point number one. That's one side of the coin. Point number two is the other side of the coin. That whenever you leave your comfort zone, there are the things you factor which you will lose, and then there are many things which you never realized which you're going to lose. A person can leave yeshiva and say, I'm going to the other yeshiva. I remember I switched yeshivas once. I come to the new yeshiva and I discover there's no dinner. There's breakfast and lunch. Now, you know, comes dinner time, and I ask the guy next to me, when's dinner served? And he said, dinner's not served. And suddenly I have to figure out how I'm funding, how I'm supporting myself to cover my cost of dinner every night. Because there's no dinner being served in this yeshiva. I didn't factor that when I switched yeshivas, that I now will have to work to fund my dinner. I'm going to lose a certain amount of time to a day to be able to have dinner. So there are simple things that we don't appreciate in our current state, that whenever we're prepared for change, we also have to factor there's going to be the change that we're not prepared for. There are going to be those benefits and those blessings that we have right now, which we haven't even taken into account. And that's it's a certain weakness. It shouldn't prevent us from moving, and we should just be prepared for that. So when Miriam dies, the people suddenly realize, all these years we had water in her merit. The water comes back in the merit of Moshe and Aaron. The nation comes to Moshe and starts arguing. They say, it's the worst death to die of thirst. We would much rather have died in the plagues of our history. Why do we have to die like this? What do you bring us out to this desert to die of thirst? Now, when we go with Rashi's pshat, that this is the new generation, these are the people who were under 20 with the sin of the spies. So this is their first real challenge. Meaning, if we go with Rashi, this is the first real fight that Moshe's having. It's been 40 quiet years, 37 quiet years in the desert. And now we fast forward, Miriam dies, and there's a beautiful Midrash here. The Midrash says, Moshe and Aaron were sitting in mourning, and suddenly they looked up, and there was a ruckus of people coming. Moshe turns to Aaron and he says, Aaron, what do you think they're coming for? So Aaron says, what kind people, what wonderful people. They must be coming to comfort us. We just lost our sister. We're sitting here in mourning. It must be everyone's coming to comfort us. And Moshe says to Aaron, you don't understand, do you? If they were coming to comfort us, they wouldn't be having such a ruckus. If they were coming to comfort us, they wouldn't be clambering. If they were coming to comfort us, the youngsters would respect the elders. There'd be some order in the way they're coming. The way they're coming, no one's coming to comfort us. They're coming and they're going to make problems. And then they come and they start angrily talking to Moshe and Aaron. Think about it. They just lost their sister. And this is one of the challenges in leadership, that you don't exactly get a time off. Right? So they're sitting in mourning and the people come clambering in and say, hey, what you doing? We're going to die. There's no water. They're still sitting in Shiva. But that didn't bother anyone. Like, we need water. What'd you take us out of Egypt for? What an evil place you brought us to. We don't have all the lush fruits you promised us. There isn't even water. So Moshe and Aaron have to retreat into the Ohel Moed. And their Ribon Shom shows up and tells Moshe and Aaron, the people have a point. And here we will invoke what we learned in the Drashot Aran, that one of the claims the people had on Moshe and Aaron was, you guys are so holy, we're not there. Why aren't you concerned we don't have water? You're the leaders. So when Hashem appears, he tells Moshe, go help the people. They have a claim, they need water. And so Hashem tells Moshe, take the staff. And this is one of the deep moments in Torah, where Hashem says words that we have to look at the words and realize we don't understand what's going on here. Hashem says, take the staff and gather the people. Why do you need the staff to gather the people? Why do the people have to be gathered? They need water. Hashem says, take the staff and gather the people. You and Aaron, your brother. Why does Hashem say you? Hashem's talking to him. Why does Hashem have to add Aaron, your brother? We know he's his brother. And you both will speak to the rock. What were they supposed to tell the rock? What do you tell the rock? And why was he carrying the staff? speak to the rock opposite their eyes, and the rock will give its waters. Its waters? The rock has waters, it's just a question of convincing it. Could you please give us some? What does that mean? And you will take out water on their behalf from that rock. Moshe's taking out the water? Or God's taking out the water? Moshe's taking out the water, or the rock is letting go of its water, the way it was said a minute ago? And you will give the congregation to drink and their cattle. Moshe has to water them. He's going to pour everyone a cup. I'm just reading the pasuk in English to point out that the pasuk on its surface level is very difficult. The pasuk is telling us a lot of things. This is probably the key pasuk in Moshe's life, because coming off of this pasuk, Moshe is going to take the staff, and the pasuk reiterates he took the staff the way God commanded him. Why did the pasuk tell us that? Because God did command him to take the staff, but why? Moshe and Aaron gather the people, and then Moshe does the talking, but God said Moshe and Aaron should talk. And Moshe says, listen here, rebellious ones, you want us to take out water from this rock? Okay, were they supposed to take out the water? Who's supposed to take out the water? What did Hashem say? Hashem said, you take out the water. Moshe says, we. Who's the we? Moshe and Aaron, or Moshe and Hashem? Hashem and Moshe. Like Moshe and the rock.
It's like everyone's confused and contradicting themselves. And like,
I want to point out, when we read the parasha, it's so easy to point a finger and say, here's what Moshe did, this is what's wrong, this is what he should have done right. And perhaps we'll take the time to analyze many different interpretations the commentaries give us. But I want us to appreciate the complexity in reading these verses. And then Moshe lifted his hand and hit the rock. Notice how the Torah sometimes zooms in. He lifted his hand. The Torah goes down to the detail. He lifted his hand and then he hit. Why does it say he lifted his hand? Do I care if he lifted his hand to hit the rock? And he hit the rock twice. Why does that matter? Maybe he did it 10 times. Bam, bam, bam. I don't know. Why does that matter? I'm saying, what's the Torah telling us? And then much water came out, and the congregation and their flocks drank. But God told Moshe, you will give them to drink. Ah, that's called he gave them to drink. And then Hashem tells Moshe and Aaron, because you didn't believe me. Wait a second, where did Aaron come into all this? What did Aaron do? Aaron seems like a silent bystander. You should have sanctified me opposite the eyes of Israel, and that's why you won't bring the congregation into the land I've given them. These are the waters of the fight where Israel fought God, and he became sanctified in their midst. What sanctification happened here? And what does it mean Israel fought God? What did Israel do? Initially, Hashem seemed to side with the people. So I'm tempted to leave you with all these questions. It's not a bad idea. I'm saying, food for thought. You have a whole week to learn. Okay, maybe we should address some of them. Yeah? Okay. That's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. Yeah?
Thursday night learning Parsha edition.
Don't kill my daddy.
Okay. Okay, point number one. The Torah tells us Moshe did something wrong. Then it's important for us to know. The Torah will reiterate numerous times, Moshe and Aaron don't go into the land of Israel because of what they did here. So that can be understood in two ways. Chazal say, it's similar to a person who did something minuscule wrong, and the king is going to punish him. So he says, please, put a sign on me why you're punishing me. People shouldn't think I did something very serious wrong. You know, I remember when I was once driving with bald tires, and an officer pulled me aside, and he starts checking me to see if I'm a drunk driver. And I didn't know what he wanted from my life, because I was driving under the speed limit. I was driving in lane. I didn't do anything wrong. I was seatbelted. Everything was right. And he pulls me over, and he's talking to me real tough. And after about 2 minutes, he realizes everything's normal. So I said, why'd you pull me over? What did I do wrong? So he said, you were driving in your lane like this. I thought you were drunk. I said, I don't know. I was holding the steering wheel. I thought I was driving straight. So he checks my tires and he says, yeah, your tires are all worn out. You need new tires. That's why even though you were holding straight, your car kept swerving a little bit within its lane and I thought you were drunk. So I said, okay, so I'll fix that. So he said, yeah, you will. And he pulls out his pad and writes me a ticket. So I said, I didn't know there was a law that you had to have your tires. Like, I didn't know I was doing something wrong. So the guy says, okay, when you come to the judge, you'll have a court date on this ticket, and you'll tell him that I said that if you bring him a receipt that you changed your tires, he should waive the ticket. I want to make sure you change your tires. Okay, go fight with the policeman. I remember going to court thinking, everyone around me, what are they thinking? What am I coming to court for, right? Why is he going to court? What did he do wrong, right? So Chazal say, when the Torah reiterates, Moshe and Aaron died because of what they did with the waters. So the Torah was pointing out, don't think there were other things that no one knew, that there was a reason why Moshe was punished. The Torah keeps pointing out, this is why. There's no other reason. Okay, that's Medrash number one. Hi, Benny.
But you said the opposite.
That could be. What did I say?
Well, that there was, if he was right in killing the Egyptian, and there was, if he was right, there was a discussion between Moshe and God at the end of Moshe's life.
Right. Right. So is that the opposite?
Well, that would imply that he was partially incorrect for killing the Egyptian.
I didn't say Moshe led a perfect life. I said the cause for his death was singular. There were definitely other areas where what Moshe did was not right. The Torah says so.
But then how do you understand that?
That's a good question for Thursday night or Rosh Hashanah Rabbah, one or the other. You're right that the Medrash does bring us a conversation between Moshe and the Ribon Shalom. But I'll give you just an opening of a thought. That Medrash is focused on a different question. That Midrash is focused not on the question of why Moshe had to die, but rather on why Moshe could not be the exception to humanity to live forever. It's a different question. Think about it. I understand right now it seems the same to you. Think about it for a minute. Yes?
But there's an interesting question that, because when Moshe was arguing with Hashem at the beginning of Shemot, and Hashem says, now you will see what the Pharaoh,
okay. You want a source that answers your question, or you want me to go into it? You prefer I go into it?
Yeah.
My only concern is that if we take the 5 to 10 minutes to discuss your question, we'll have a very nice Tvar Torah, not mine, the Beit Yishai, but we won't address this part of the parasha. So I would rather leave for Thursday night. You're going to be around?
Yes.
Good. So let's reopen that conversation Thursday night. Okay? And if you want, in the interim, you could look up, there's a book called Beit Yishai by Rav Shlomo Fisher, who addresses that question. Yes?
I like this as a proof that Torah is true. Because Moshe, if he wrote the Torah, not Hashem, he will leave this part out. That he makes a mistake. He will make himself perfect, like Muhammad, or there are other people.
We had, a few weeks ago, the Torah recorded that when Aaron's two sons died, in Sefer Vayikra, right, in Parashat Shmini, so, Ve'etzirah chatat arosh torash Moshe minei soraf. Moshe asked them, what did you do with the chatas sacrifice of Rosh Chodesh? They say, we burnt it. Vayiktzof Moshe al Elazar. Moshe got angry at Elazar and Itamar, and he says to them, Madua, why did you burn that? You were supposed to eat it. And they deferred to Aaron. They didn't want to argue with Moshe, even though they didn't agree. And they said to, and Aaron says to Moshe, he says, Aaron says he lost his two sons on that day. And that's why halachically he thought that the Rosh Chodesh sacrifice went under the regular ordinances of the temple, where a person who lost their children that day could not eat from it, nor could his two sons. The unique sacrifices of the day, God said eat them even though they lost their relative. But the sacrifice that was a regular Rosh Chodesh sacrifice should not be eaten. Moshe says, you're right, says the Medrash. Moshe said, bring the trumpets, blow a blast, gather the people. Make an announcement. I want everyone to hear. I made a mistake. I said they should have eaten the sacrifice, and Aaron pointed out to me why I was wrong. Please tell everyone. So Chazal tell us that Moshe was not only humble, he was desperately interested in the truth being known. And his honor was not a factor. His honor was completely irrelevant. So when he made a mistake, he said, tell everyone, let's make sure people don't learn from my mistake. I want everyone to know this is what's right. So I think we have other examples of that, where that was Moshe's interest. Coming back to our parsha. Okay. Concept number one. When Hashem runs the world, Hashem created systems. So there are systems in our physical life. We know the blood pumps blood, right? The heart pumps blood, right? What would happen if a person doesn't have a heart? He could live, and maybe not, right? We don't see people living without a heart. Ah, so today you can have a mechanical heart. Okay, but technically we know that within the system, you slit a person's throat, so within 2 minutes he's dead, right? There's a system in the world. So Ramban and Ran, they both developed the idea that in the spiritual world, Hashem also created a system. And that's where there's a temptation to try to tap into that system, and that's part of the idea of idol worship, where people say, why should I talk to God? He's on top of the system. Let me talk to someone lower down in the system. And that's where there's an element of truth in the idol worship, because people were trying to tap into the system that exists. That's why the Midrash says sometimes people would do idol worship by accessing angels. There were ways that people knew about to access forces that exist in the world. So what's relevant to us in our parsha is that in the world we live in, there's also a spiritual system. There isn't just the physical system we're familiar with, laws of gravity, laws of physics, etc. There's also a spiritual system to this world. So far we're all together? Okay. In that spiritual system, one of the things Hashem created was that where spirituality appears once, it's easier for it to appear again. It's as though once it's happened once, it can happen again more easily. Even though you'll say, isn't everything easy for God? And the answer is yes. It's part of the system. So if Hashem is about to do a miracle, on many miracles, Hashem says, bring the staff along. And the staff brings with it spirituality. You asked me earlier tonight, does a holy thing impart holiness on other things? Is there such a concept that something spiritual affects things that are around it? So Chazal say yes.
There's Av Tumah, there's Av Tumah, then there's like it's descending levels of Tumah, but it's still metameh to a certain extent.
So that's where we got into the subject, right? That's where we started the idea. So in spirituality, there's also that. And that's the concept that we find that when Eliyahu is standing by the mountain and they look around and they see that the Aramean army has brought a whole battalion and surrounded his tent. So he prays to God and he says, let the lad see that we have more soldiers than they do. And then the lad sees that there are chariots of fire all around Elisha, I think, not Elio, Elisha, all around Elisha by his tent. So why did the lad see? Because when spirituality comes down on Elisha, it can overflow to the lad that's next to him. In the parsha we read a few weeks ago, when Moshe gets prophecy, so the 70 elders who are standing next to him can get prophecy even though they're not worthy of it. Because there is this concept that where there's spirituality for one, it can overflow and affect others, even if they're not worthy of it. So the Ran says, that was the idea of taking the staff. The staff represented something that turned into a serpent in Pharaoh's palace, was taken out of the Garden of Eden, had engraved on it Hashem's hidden name. It was something that represented spirituality and miracles over and over and over again. Did the staff specifically have powers? Or was the staff a representation of spirituality in the world? So the staff, taking the staff was not for the purpose of talking. They didn't need the staff to bring out the water. But Hashem said, it's part of the system I created. Bring something spiritual with you. You're not going to bring the ark with you. You're not going to bring the Holy of Holies with you. But bring that staff with you. because that staff sat in the Holy of Holies. That staff sat in the holiest place because the staff was representative. It came from the Garden of Eden. It was representative of spirituality. So it was supposed to be present, not active. What was Moshe's transgression with regards to the people? So here there are different understandings, and I want to go with one. There are many. Rashi goes with the understanding you should have spoken to the rock, and he interpreted it to mean hit the rock. We have to develop Rashi. It's a, you can't leave it at that level. You have to understand what that means. Moshe didn't understand God. How does that work? So that deserves its own discussion. I don't want to go that route. I want to go with Maimonides. Maimonides goes with the Midrash that says Moshe's transgression was that he said to the people, listen here, rebellious ones. God didn't tell him to talk that way. So when the people are asking for water, they're thirsty in the middle of a desert, and they're saying, Moshe, with all due respect to your Shiva and your lost sister, you have 2 million people here who need water. You have to stop your mourning and come deal with us. Hashem sided with the people, not with Moshe. And what Moshe did when Moshe said, listen here, rebellious ones, was he gave them a message that didn't come from God. He gave them a message, you were inappropriate in your request for water. So the people were rowdy. The Midrash says, when Moshe came to produce water, they started saying, Moshe, if you're really a messenger of God, you don't need that rock, do it from this rock. You don't need that rock, do it from this rock. They started challenging him and taunting him. They really got under his skin. But when Moshe, being the messenger of God, yelled at them, Moshe was giving them a message that God hadn't said. And so Hashem tells Moshe, I'm going to take you to task on this. Because when I take you to task on this, I'm telling the people, every other word you said, Moshe emet v'torato emet. Every other word you said, I said. That word I didn't say. And the greater the person, Chazal say, the more Hashem takes them to task over the most minute thing. So when Moshe yells at the people, we can understand it from the Midrash that it was wrong that he was upset with them. He shouldn't have lost his cool. Or the way the Rambam develops it a little bit further, he was giving them a message from Hashem, inadvertently, that Hashem had not said. And even though you'd say it's the most minuscule thing, he just yelled at them for a second. He just told them, why are you guys being so disruptive? Why are you so rebellious? And they were being rowdy. They were tormenting him. But God hadn't told him to say that. And when Hashem took him to task over that, Hashem was telling the people, you should know every other letter of what Moshe said, down to the sentiment, is a tradition, it's something he got from me. This that he said, I didn't say, and that's why I'm taking him to task over it, and I'm not going to let go. Hashem says, I'm not going to forgive it, because this is my way of showing the world that every other word you said is true. So that's one interpretation. Again, there are many interpretations, but this is one. Obviously, Moshe is a giant. And obviously, when we speak about Moshe, we should be careful not to allow ourselves to speak freely about someone who is greater than what we can imagine. I mean, we don't understand what Moshe is. But that's one idea in the story of Moshe. Moshe and Aaron. And the rest of the parsha, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll see in parsha on Thursday night. We'll conclude the parsha. I'm reminded